Welcome back to Reflections. Your host, Jorge Gonzalez. My guest today is Bill Mann, a fellow classmate at my prep school, high school at Andover. And we discussed, first of all, reunions, which is what brought Bill to Puerto Rico for the third time. And what I wanted to get into, some crucial moments in a life. And I was thinking of, you know, the 40s and 30s, but before that, I think because of Sandover, that the experience in that first year, and I think yours, we now realize, incidentally, when we were there, nobody talked about how difficult things were going and how scared and completely stressed out we were. We were, stiff lip, you know. But as we get to this year, we find out that so many of us were going through the same thing. But tell me your experience in your first year of Andover. Incidentally, you had your father. So you're kind of a legacy. Okay.
Well, so my dad was grew up in the Depression and graduated from high school. He went to 22 different schools before he got to college. Yeah, my grandfather's job just had him moving. And sadly, one of the reasons I didn't retire much earlier was his occupation was as a stockbroker during the Depression. Well, that was not a good occupation after the Black Friday. It
could be very depressing.
Yeah, very depressing. And my dad did a PG year, just a one-year postgraduate, and then went to Dartmouth.
Okay.
So, yeah, so for me, you're sort of reflecting on what you just said. We knew the smart ones, but we didn't know all the rest of us were kind of the dummies. I mean, we kind of clammed up, and I struggled, and partly it was because, education came easy to me. I never studied. I didn't know how to study. I
mean, you went to a public school?
Public school.
In New Jersey?
Public high school, and George Washington Junior High in Ridgewood, New Jersey. And, got great grades and just, never kind of broke a sweat. And then I got to Andover, and now it's a small fish in a big pond, and people were smarter than me. I mean, you knew the really smart ones, and the rest of us were struggling. So I was telling you the stories. I got through about halfway through, they realized I was doomed for failure. And my dad came up, and Josh Miner, who was then the director of admissions, was a friend of my dad's. He kind of took me under my wing, and they gave me the choice, either buckle up or, you're coming back, either to public school.
What was your average at the public school last year?
Oh, it's like straight A's.
Yeah, so 95.
I don't know that they did. I don't think they did numerical. I think they were. So on a numerical scale, that would be in the 90s.
Yeah.
So I get to Andover, and my average of, I think, five courses at Andover the first year was 62, and I only flunked one course. So you can.
And below 60 is flunking, right?
Yeah. Below 60 is flunking. So I was.
You were there in the 61, 63, 60.
I was in the 62% percentile, and not good. And so what happened was I buckled down and I tried to figure out, and Latin was my worst course. And my teacher actually told Josh Miner that the highest he expected me to do on the exam was 47. I don't know where he came up with that number. It was 47. And so I take the exam, and I got a 67, and he thought he'd made a mistake, so he took it to two other teachers to make sure that he had graded it properly. So the long of short was they would permit me to come back if I basically took the exam again, so I went during summer school, took another Latin course and improved. And so, the rest was kind of history. So I still was middle of the heap, but it made me. I mean, I think you take adversity and you take it on and it makes you a better person.
But you got in. I didn't get in. I was rejected. And I went to summer school, and my first English essay was a 55. My first math exam was a 0. Yeah. I had a 27 average, and I was going to soberly show them that I – so anyway, but surprisingly, I got in, and I had about a 66, 67 average that first year.
Oh, you were much smarter than me.
But I think I took a Spanish course, and that gave me like a 74.
That's cheating. I didn't get that benefit.
I had taken Latin. I would have had a 60 maybe. Oh, but anyway, we went through a crucible of fire that first year, and founded in 1778, and as you say, you get there and you realize it brings a lot of humility to us. You think you're big wig, and then you're brought down to size in that thing. And so you and I went through exactly the same experience. And talking with a lot of my classmates, they suffered also. Some people had easy. We're going to have, incidentally, I mentioned as we were going over Jose Raul, my cousin, and he's one that, had it. Some people had it easy. They're really exceptionally intelligent. Jose Raul was one of them, but most of us went through hell, and it was at 14, 15 years old.
To me, it wasn't until the 50th reunion that I realized that when they finally fessed up and said, "Oh yeah, I had the same problem." I was like, "Oh, I wasn't the only one."
Okay, what was the next kind of critical juncture in your life where major change that you realize I've got to look at things differently now. What was another critical moment? You haven't reached it yet.
The epiphany may still be coming. I'm not sure. Back in those days, it's kind of interesting. My wife kids about, she went to college to get what she called an MRS degree. She wanted to get married. Mm-hmm. So her brother's introduced to me, and so we've been married now 59 years. We have this, 60th is next year.
Right.
And
both Bill and I got married in 1966, so we're going to be celebrating 60 years with our respective wives.
So her joke is, when we say that, she says, "Yeah, but it was only 35 good ones."
Good Lord.
And my cynical friends will come to me and say, "Well, tell me about the bad ones."
So there you are, going along in life with a lot of different law firms and all, and pushing along, really doing well, and three kids and grandchildren. What happened? Anything happened? Is everything smooth or something?
Yeah. So the sort of pivotal moment was my wife's mother, who I called Mama C. Her maiden name was Sarah Craver, so Mama C was the Craver. Got terminal cancer and spent. She lived about 3.5 hours away, and so for a year before she died, they diagnosed it. As a matter of fact, they didn't think she'd live more than a month, and she lived almost a year. My wife spent basically Monday through Friday with her mother in Shelby, and then would come back on the weekends. And so she would take our youngest son, who was then five. So he actually graduated from two different kindergartens, one in Raleigh and one in Shelby. It's this little town near Charlotte. And her mother was a Christian, and she had something that was, I could see that I didn't have. And it, took a year to sort of get through it. And so she finally died in June, but in February, I finally realized that I needed something beyond myself, and that's when I became a Christian. And that was a game changer for me.
You were an atheist at that moment, agnostic?
I won't say that. There's a sort of technical definition of what is a Christian and what's not a Christian, but I became born again. That's sort of the technical term. But I realized that there was something beyond me that I needed help in. And where it sort of changed me, it changed my concept of being the leader of my family. And how I sort of related to my kids. And the other thing it did, which is totally unexpected, up until that point in my life, I was basically very comfortable being in the background. If you'd asked me to go get on a stage and talk or be a leader of some sort, the upfront guy, that was the last thing in my thing. And the next thing I know, I have this faith journey, and everything happens to me, and all of a sudden I'm a leader. I'm on you know, we joined a church. They put me on the board. And
but in your 50th, you said you started two churches.
Yeah, I started two churches. very different. Yeah, exactly. Very different. One was, it's called Crossroads Fellowship. It's in Raleigh. It's now what they call a mega church. It's got 6,000 members. And it was non-denominational, but a conservative church. And then we had issues of leadership. There were several people on the elder board with me, and we could see it. It was actually heresy. It was actually deeper than it. It played out as a moral failure in the pastor. But we had agreed as elders that we would lead by consensus, and we basically pointed out that there was a problem with the pastor and that there would be no consensus. So we withdrew. We resigned. And then a year later, it came out in a moral failure, and so that was one church. And then we went sort of liturgical. Went to an Episcopal church, and then helped start one that was an Anglican church, which is actually a interesting thing. It was the Anglican was kind of a
Was it the same elders that group went together, or you were on your
actually,
own?
Actually, yeah. At the end of the day, we all ended up sort of in this, and we're still sort of together.
Okay.
And so this Anglican church was actually sponsored, probably the best way to describe it, by the Anglican Church in Rwanda, of all places. And it was called AMIA, Anglican Mission in America, and the African Anglican Church saw that a conservative church needed to be as an alternative to the Episcopal Church. And so they started, many of the Episcopal churches went to the Anglican Church. We happened, the one in Raleigh was a church plant. So we didn't have any property. That was kind of the issue with the conversions, because who gets the church?
Mm-hmm.
Who owns it?
Right.
Yeah, and so that got to be legal issues and that sort of thing. We were church plant, so we were renting property, so they didn't care. Matter of fact, at one point in time, we were the second largest tenant in a mall before it got turned down because stores were vacating, and I think we moved 6 or 7 different times before they actually bought a building. So I became Anglican, which frankly made me appreciate liturgy, which is part of the Catholic tradition, the church calendar and those sorts of things. And that was it. But all of a sudden I found myself in leadership and my law firm, small law firm, we had at the time 20 lawyers in Raleigh that I helped start in 76, merged with this international firm, and the next thing you know, I'm on the management committee of a $400 million enterprise, wondering how the heck did I get here?
How many lawyers are the Graham and?
Graham and James.
Graham James, yeah.
At its high watermark, probably 750. When we merged, it was only like 350, but it grew rapidly. We were at 17 offices. And I look back at those days, other than being a frequent flyer, I literally was logging 300,000 to 400,000 miles a year. We were everywhere. The sun never set on our law firm. And it was a Pacific Rim firm, so we had offices in Beijing and Hong Kong and Tokyo and all through Southeast Asia. And I ended up with just great friends all over the world. It was just a remarkable thing. And that's how I became friends with, say, a classmate of yours from Harvard, Ed Reeser, who still is a good friend to this day. He now lives in Idaho. He retired, so I keep up with these guys, and I think that's rewarding. It's enriching. I think relationships has made my life better. They've made me better.
And this religious change in your life. I know that we kept on base. We're friends on Facebook and. And I read your podcast, your blogs. I don't know what we call it, but Mentor Link. But you spend a lot of time in your life. This is from the 40s, doing missionary work in different parts, especially Africa.
Yeah.
How much time do you? When did that start? And how much time do you spend at that?
Well, I think my first transition was when I sort of first came to faith in it, and I'd have to say the other thing that helped me was I got into a Bible study. So literally, I remember this. They had something called BSF, which is Bible Study Fellowship, and it was for all denominations. But frankly, it shouldn't have existed if the church had continued, you know, teaching the Bible, having people read the Bible. But it was freestanding, I get invited to this, and I go into this church, and here's 500 men, some of whom I knew, many of whom I knew from outside the church. I say, what's he doing here? Just thinking about what his life looked like. I'm going like, are you? Of course, they looked at me the same way. They say, oh, what's Bill doing here?
I thought you were a lawyer.
No, I thought you were a reprobate, you know. But what that did is it gave me a grounding that was really helpful. And so I grew. I mean, I grew in my knowledge of it. And actually later on, after the first year, the leader came to me and said, we'd like you to be a leader of one of our small groups, 15 men. And I said, look, I'm a rookie. I mean, this is all new to me. So I remember from that first group, I sat down and I got.
You were about what, 45?
In the 40s. And so I'm sitting here with this first group of guys, like, you know, 1 year out of the box, and we're studying Genesis. And I said to him, I said, okay, guys, you need to understand something. We're going to do Genesis, but don't ask me a question on Exodus because I haven't read it. We'll get to that eventually. So that was sort of the biblical scriptural grounding that helped me get to where I am. And then the other significant thing for me was a mutual friend of mine, a guy named Floyd Green. He was actually a seminary grad. He went to Dallas Theological Seminary, and one of his Dallas buddies, Stacy Reinhardt, and I got to know each other, and we were having lunch, and Floyd said, I wish I had a spiritual board of directors that we could meet and sort of, you know, we can direct each other. So that started in like the late 80s, early 90s. And so we started meeting on a weekly basis, having lunch, just talking about life, what's going on in our life, you know, and sometimes using it as a sounding board of, I've got this issue, you know, am I wrong? Is this, you know, what direction should I go? And that was pivotal for me. And so that's continued to this day. And I sort of kid about it. I said, in the early years, our meetings were, whether we ate for lunch or breakfast or where we met, were a function of our work schedules. Now, sadly, it's a function of our medical appointments.
I get a kick. We're run out of time in the second segment, but when we come back, I want to go in to you had the spiritual thing. I want to go into then with the spiritual group or yourself introspectively as you developed towards 81, you know, your perspective in life and looking at death. I mean, this is profound stuff. So we'll get into that.
It is profound.
This next segment. This is when you're listening to is Bill Mann, my classmate at Andover, is here for the Andover reunion. This is Reflections. Your host, Jorge Gonzalez. We'll be back after the pause.